not punish him for something he has not done. I'm not looking to punish him, Henry. But there's got to be something better for the man than living under I-25. His face remained impassive as he answered, "Perhaps. But that is something for him to discover, not for you to give him." We walked along. "Well, maybe I can help." The bear smiled. "I know. This is not the first set of moccasins in which you have walked." Chapter 14. The bear stood up from his hunter's crouch where he'd been studying the motorcycle tracks. "They are the same." I took the key I'd gotten from the office and unlocked the door to room number 5 and ducked under the sheriff's line do not cross tape we'd festooned across the door. At the front desk, I had asked the girl who had one headphone in her ear if she'd heard any motorcycles this morning, but she'd said no. I asked her if she usually wore both headphones while cleaning. She said yes, she did. I asked her if she'd cleaned Tuyen's room this morning. She said that she would have cleaned the room, but that he hadn't been around, and they never entered a room without the occupant's expressed permission. I asked her if she was kidding. She said she wasn't. I asked about the previous night, but she said that they pretty much closed up at 9 and always left a number that would reach the owners if there were any problems, that they lived only 3/4 of a mile away. I told her she could put the other headphone back in, though. I had turned Bill McDermott and his crew loose. I figured that the more important crime scene was the Dietz barn, and that Henry and I could go over to Yen's room as a preliminary before calling in the cavalry. The place was as I'd left it hours before. There was a large bloodstain at the foot of the bed, a smaller one further in, and an intermittent trail that led to the adjoining room and bathroom. I turned and looked at Henry, who was still standing in the doorway. "If you came through that door and someone was waiting to hit you, where would they stand?" He looked around the entryway and to his right.
"Behind the door."
"Okay, you want to come in and close that?" He did as requested and then joined me in looking at the distance from the door to the first bloodstain. "What did he do, jump when he got hit?"
"Perhaps the assailant waited until he was farther inside."
I shook my head. "Doesn't make sense. I mean, if you were planning on getting somebody, would you wait until he closed the door and took 3 or 4 steps before you hit him? Especially someone as physically capable as Tuyen?"
"So you think he knew him?"
I walked toward the bed and kneeled beside the larger of the two stains. "I didn't get much out of him, but he said that someone had struck him from behind, that he had hit the ground, started to get up, failed, and then hit the floor again." Henry stood by the dresser.
"That would explain the first pool of blood. And then he tries to get up and falls where the smaller one is. Did he say he was unconscious before you got there?"
"Off and on." He squatted down beside me.
"Where was the wound?"
"Right side of the head and toward the back. Just at the crown."
"Just one?" "I'm not sure."
Henry looked back toward the door.
"Is it possible that he was struck once, and then, when he started to rise, the assailant hit him again? That would explain the 2 stains."
"It's possible." I studied the spread that had been flung back from the corner of the bed, revealing the end of the angle-iron bed rail and the corner of the mattress stained with blood. Henry studied the corner of the bed frame.
"So he was struck and then hit the corner?"
"Maybe." The Cheyenne Nation studied me.
"What are you thinking?"
"I'm thinking I want to talk to Tuyen." I stood and noticed that the metal case that was in Tuyen's car was on the dresser. Under the strictest sense of the law, I'm not really supposed to be going through his personal items.
"No."
I walked over to the bureau and flipped the leather-wrapped handle. "He didn't say anything about missing his wallet, and nothing else in the room seems disturbed, which leads me to believe that it wasn't a robbery attempt." I nudged the corner of the case with my finger. "Heavy. Possibly a computer.
If I was going to steal something in this room, I think I'd start with this.
Yes.
That makes this a suspicious item.
Yes.
And as a duly appointed law enforcement official, it would be my responsibility to open it.
Yes.
There's only one problem.
Yes.
It's locked. With a sigh of exasperation, Henry slid the case toward him and flipped it up, looking at the four-digit combination. He paused for a moment and then rolled the thumb wheels until it read 1975.
Fall of Saigon.
Click. Saigon, Vietnam, 1968. I heard the safety go off, but wasn't sure where. The bouncer still stood in front of us, big, too big to be Vietnamese, probably Samoan. Our noses were about 6 inches apart. I was a couple of inches taller, but he probably had me by a good 40 pounds. The really disconcerting part was that he was the one wearing a cowboy hat. Baranski held his badge over my shoulder into the giant's face. Look, Babu, criminal investigation detachment. We're on a homicide investigation. That much was true. We're working with your own Arvin intelligence sector. Not particularly true. And if you don't step aside, I'm going to tell USMC Specialist Longmire here to drag you over to the Long Bin Stockade and specialize in stomping a puddle in your chest and walking the motherfucker dry.
Hopefully true.
He didn't move, but after a few seconds, he turned toward a slick-looking little fellow standing to the side, who disappeared behind the giant and then reappeared. He nodded his head, and the bouncer slipped to the left. I took a step forward, but kept my face to him as Baranski and Mendoza passed behind me.
Fuck you, son of bitch.
I slowly smiled my best Powder River grin, the one that would have made Owen Wister proud. Smile when you call me that. Western Town's theme was Western, but whose was anybody's guess? The ubiquitous dancing girls wore white go-go cowgirl boots and either cheap costume cowboy hats or multicolored war bonnets, the kind that came from the Woolworths back home. In the dim light, I could see the walls were raggedly festooned with Western movie posters that were hand-painted with Vietnamese print or maybe Japanese. I could hardly move with the amount of people in the place. Nearly all were locals, but the few servicemen who were mixed in with the mass of civilians were mostly enlisted. It looked like we were the brass, for better and probably worse. Mendoza and Baranski were already scouting the crowd, but from their continued craning, it was pretty clear that they hadn't spotted Hollywood Huang yet. Mendoza leaned in and spoke above the music. "You stay here, man, and we'll walk through and see if we can't flush him out." "What about the back?" He shook his head. "This your first time to the rodeo? There ain't no back door." I watched as they disappeared into the crowd. There was a dance floor where Jim Ed Brown's Papa Top warbled through the narrow building and made me homesick. I planted myself against a newel post leading to a stairwell to the basement and a beaded door. I was tired, and all I wanted to do was sleep, so I closed my eyes for only a second. When I opened them, there was a teensy Vietnamese woman in a brightly feathered child's war bonnet who was standing on tiptoes to get my attention. "You like dance?"
"No, thanks."
"I give special place?"
"No, that's okay."
It was easy to see over her. Only the tips of the feathers were in my line of sight. With the constant flux of people going in and out, it was hard to keep track, but if Huang was wearing his trademark powder blue jumpsuit and white silk scarf, I figured he'd be easy to pick out of the crowd. She stepped in closer and put her hands on my uniform.
"Special private dance?"
I blew on the feathers to get them away from my face.
"No, really."
"You look for friend?"
"No."
I glanced down, and her eyes carried a greater intensity than they should have.
"What?"
Her voice lowered, but still held the same urgency.
"You look for friend?"
I was glancing over her head for either Baranski or Mendoza, neither of whom were in sight.
"No, really, I'm a monk."
She stared at me for a moment, looked back into the main part of the room, and then glanced down the stairs leading to the basement.
"Only you."
I stood there looking at the sheen of the Southeast Asian night on her skin, and thought of my Kim. I was assaulted by the hokey music, and the tumblers fell into place. "Do you know Huang? Hollywood Huang?" Her eyes flicked back over her shoulder and then down the stairs again.
"Only you."
"Is Huang down there?" Her face remained immobile. "I'm not going to hurt him, but I can't leave this spot unless he's down there." The feathers bobbed imperceptibly as she nodded. My nod was just as slight. I slipped around the railing and started down the steps and thought about Huang, how much he'd thanked me for saving his life in Khe San, and how, if he'd really wanted to kill me, he probably would have already. He'd certainly had a bunch of opportunities. But you never knew. I unsnapped the strap on my .45 and pulled the hammer back. There was no door, just the beaded curtain. And it was dark. I thought about what a great backlit target I was making, parted the curtain, and stepped through. The basement was even narrower than the bar. I walked past a dirt shelf that held a bunch of tiny compressors that looked more like gerbil wheels than coolers as they valiantly attempted to keep the upstairs, well, cool. There were boxes to my left, stacked to the ceiling as far as the light from the doorway would allow me to see. Jim Ed Brown had given way to Buck Owens and the Buckaroos upstairs, so I raised my voice a little and rolled the loaded but still holstered dice. "Juan?" I thought I could make out the sound of a movement behind me and to my right. I turned slowly and looked into the beer can barrel of a Walther PPK silenced pistol. His eyes were wide, and sweat had saturated the powder blue jumpsuit to a sopped navy. I raised my hands without being bidden. "How are you, Huang?" He didn't say anything, and scanned to the right for anybody who might have been following me. "I'm alone." His eyes couldn't remain still, and I could see the barrel of the pistol shaking in his hands.
"My Kim,
she's dead."
His eyes welled, and he half swallowed, like there was something in his throat that wouldn't go down. He looked at the ground between us, but the pistol stayed where it was. After a few seconds, his voice wavered.
"You know who killed her?"
I lowered my hands a little, and he didn't seem to take exception, so I let them drop to my sides and slowly placed the .45 in my duty holster, but left the safety off and the leather strap unsnapped. "You know, that's funny. We had a little discussion about that. Your name came up." He shook his head vehemently.
"I no kill my Kim."
I was developing a hard-fought talent in Vietnam for being able to tell if people were lying to me. He was convincing, and I let the weight of it settle and drift us toward more conversation.
"Well, then, who did?"
"I no kill my Kim."
The fat barrel faltered a moment, then came closer to my face. I turned my palms out and took a half-step back, dropped my gun hand down, and gestured with the other.
"All right, all right."
He switched the gun to his other hand.
"If you didn't kill her, then why are you holding a pistol on me?"
His lips compressed and he swallowed again, the barrel not moving.
"You on up?"
"What?"
"You on up?"
I inclined my head. "You mean the up and up?" He nodded.
"Up, up."
I took a breath and sighed.
"Yep. I'm on the up-up, or else why would I be in a bar basement off 2 Doe Street with my sidearm back in its holster?"
He paused for a moment, took a deep breath that caused his whole body to shudder, and then lowered the Walther. I took another half-step back to show him I'd meant what I'd said, leaned against the dirt shelf and listened to the rickety compressors and Buck and the Buckaroos.
"Huang, if I wanted you dead, I'd have left you in the mud at Khe San."
His eyes were steadier now, even with the sweat coursing down his face.
"No mortar."
"What?"
"No mortar."
He said it again, emphasizing each word. "What is that supposed to mean?"
"At Khe San, no mortar."
I felt cold, and it had nothing to do with the temperature.
"You mean the round that hit the helicopter?"
He gestured with the pistol, the barrel coming up and to my left.
"No mortar. Timer was..."
The shot compressed the confined space, and the spray of blood splattered in my eyes, making me blink.
It didn't feel like I was hit, but something was falling against me, and I caught it. It was Huang, choking on his own blood with a sucking wound that made ghastly noises in his chest. He was already covered with blood, and his eyes looked up at me imploringly. I lowered him to the dirt floor as Baranski and Mendoza approached with their guns drawn. I unzipped the flight suit and looked at the wound, blowing air with his breath, the bubbles flowing with the blood as it drained down Huang's side. I gently pulled the silk scarf from around his neck and raised him up, wrapping the length of cloth around and under his shoulder to secure the front and rear wounds as best I could. I looked up at the security officer and the CID investigator.
"God damn it, why did you fire?"
Baranski looked incredulous.
"Hey, new guy, I just saved your fucking life. He wasn't going to shoot."
He looked at Mendoza and then back at me.
"He was pointing that bazooka at your head, and why do you think he was using a silencer, dumbass? You were about to become the honored dead."
I ignored him and began picking Huang up.
"What are you doing?"
I pulled the tiny man against my shoulder, careful to avoid the entry and exit wounds. "I'm taking him to a hospital."
Baranski snorted. The Texan remained silent.
"He's dead."
"He's not dead."
I glanced down at the little man's eyes and watched as he blinked, but didn't seem to be able to focus on my face.
"You're not dead, do you hear me? You're hurt pretty bad, but we're going to get you to a hospital, and they'll patch you up. Do you hear me?"
His eyes clenched like they were capturing my words, and I knew he understood. I stepped forward, moving the two men back.
"And you can either help me or get out of my way."
It's amazing how fast you can clear a path in a crowded club with guns and a mortally wounded man. I climbed into the back of the jeep and carefully placed Huang on my lap. His pupils were a little constricted, and I was beginning to suspect that the pilot-slash-drug dealer might have sampled a little of his own product, and that it was the only thing that was keeping him alive. Baranski backed the jeep into the crowded street, swung it in a tight circle, and took a left at the next block. I knew the nearest hospital was in the other direction. I yelled above the shifting gears as the M1A1A veered around traffic and started north on Highway 1.
"Where the hell do you think you're going?"
he yelled back at me over his shoulder.
"I'm not taking that little dink to a civilian hospital here in Saigon where he can conveniently disappear. I'm taking him back to Tan Son Nhut."
I looked at Mendoza, who stared straight ahead with an arm braced against the dash. I looked down at Huang.
"He'll die. We've got the best medical care in Southeast Asia only 5 minutes away, so hold on and shut the hell up."
Baranski shifted into third, and the jeep slipped from the traffic and followed its headlights into the glowing dawn at the edge of the war-torn town.
"How are you feeling?"
He smiled and shrugged. "Rather foolish, actually. That and I have a headache."
"I bet you do."
I sat in the mauve-colored chair Durant Memorial provided for visitors and took off my hat, placing it onto Yen's metal case at my boots. Santiago Cesar Vittoria stood by the door and, like all good flies on the wall, was doing his best to remain inconspicuous.
"I hope you're feeling up to answering some questions."
"Oh, yes."
He used the electric control to push himself further up on the bed and pulled the pillow down lower. "They're keeping me here overnight for observation, but other than the headache, I feel fine."
"That was quite a hit you took."
"I've had worse." He glanced at the floor.
"Is that my case?"
"Yes, it is. I was thinking that you might like to have it."
"Thank you."
We were both aware that I was making no attempt at giving it to him.
"Mr. Tuyen, are you sure you don't have any idea who might have attacked you?"
He looked up.
"None whatsoever."
"Were you visited by anyone today? I mean, before the attack?"
He didn't hesitate in responding.
"No."
"You're sure?"
He waited for a moment, perhaps weighing the old adage that when law enforcement officials ask questions, they usually know the answers. He looked down at his hands.
"There was someone who came to visit me early this morning."
"And who was that?"
His eyes returned to mine.
"The bartender."
"Philip Maynard?"
"Yes."
I leaned in, placing my elbows on my knees and casually flipping my hat around by the brim.
"Do you mind telling me why you lied to me just now?"
"He wanted more money, and I didn't want to get him into trouble. It was a bad thing I did, paying him to be silent.
and I did not wish to make the same mistake again.
Mr. Tuyan, that's twice that you've dissembled when I've asked you a direct question. I'm going to advise you in the strongest terms, no matter what the circumstances, to not do it again.
He nodded. I'm sorry. What did he say? He seemed startled at my abruptness. He said that he could make my life difficult unless I gave him more money.
Difficult in what way?
The conversation didn't go much further than that. I told him that if he threatened me again, I would contact you.
I looked into my hat, knowing full well that none of the answers to my questions were there. But you didn't. You didn't tell me about Maynard's visit, his attempts at extortion, or anything. It was quiet, and we all listened to the thrum of the air conditioning. Did it ever occur to you that Philip Maynard might have been the one who killed your granddaughter, and that withholding this kind of evidence could be seen as an obstruction of justice?
I'm very sorry.
I looked at the worn label in the hatband of my hat, and then back up to Tuyen's face. Maynard left?
Yes.
How? The questioning look returned.
I'm afraid I don't...
When he left, how did he leave? On a pogo stick?
On his motorcycle.
I continued to watch him and could just see the little bits of anger at the corners of his mouth.
He came and left on his motorcycle.
I nodded. Mr. Tuyen, were you struck once or twice in your motel room?
I believe once, but I could be wrong.
Mr. Tuyen, I'm getting really tired of your inexactitude. He clutched the bridge of his nose between his thumb and forefinger.
Sheriff, my granddaughter is dead.
Mr. Tuyen, you have yet to provide me with any documentation proving that she was your granddaughter. He took a breath but kept his eyes shut.
You don't believe that...
I'm not sure exactly what I believe, but you're not making it any easier for me. I stood, placed my hat back on my head, and picked up his case. I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you for a birth certificate, either Vietnamese or American. He started to interrupt.
Sheriff, surely you understand the red tape involved.
Papers such as baptismal, school records, or anything that will lead me to believe that Ho Ti was your granddaughter. I continued to hold the case, and we were both very aware of it. Now, you can provide me with this information, or I can contact the probate courts in California and have a deputy from the Orange County Sheriff's Department expedite the information. He looked up at me and then spoke slowly.
Ho Ti was not adopted. She was my blood granddaughter.
Then I'll have them contact the Bureau of Vital Statistics in Sacramento. He nodded, and his lips tightened.
Sheriff, I did not expect to find Ho Ti dead. Any and all of her official papers, including a visa and birth documentation, are in the safe in my office back in Los Angeles.
Then you better contact someone and have that information faxed to us. And then I want the originals overnighted, now. I pulled the small 9mm from the back pocket of my jeans. And you better have a license for this. Sarzab Vittorio followed me to the old Suburban parked next to my truck. I figured I'd take it and give him the bullet. He deserved a few perks if I was going to make him work Powder Junction. That, and I wasn't sure if the aged vehicle would make it back and forth too many more times. According to how the election turned out this fall, somebody was going to have to requisition the county for a new or relatively new vehicle for the Powder Junction substation. When I looked up, Santiago stood there by my open window.
Why did you bring the laptop to the hospital?
I noted the 173,472 miles on the odometer and knew just how it felt. I thought he might want to know it was being attended to. He kept watching me, the dark of his eyes deepening. What, Sancho?
You mentioned that case a couple of times. Are you sure you didn't just want to see his reaction?
I shook my head. You have a sordid and suspicious mind.
I sat there, continuing to stare at the odometer, and wondered what the mileage really might be, since it hadn't worked in years. We couldn't get past the security software, so I figured I'd just hang on to the case for safekeeping.
How about not telling him that Maynard was dead?
I put on the loose seatbelt and ground the starter.
He has his little secrets, and I have mine.
His turn to nod. You really want me to stick around and keep an eye on him?
The Suburban finally caught and roared.
Yep, call up Freimeyer or Double Tough over at the jail and get a replacement for midnight.
He looked at the sun, which was attempting to escape over the Bighorn Mountains, and I didn't blame it or him for wanting to put a little distance between them and what appeared to be going on.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to go have dinner with my daughter, her new boyfriend, and his sister, and Henry, and then I'm going to sleep at the jail.
His arms rested on the sill of the Suburban.
You really think Tuyen's liable to do something?
I mused for a moment on how quickly the Basco was developing and how long he was likely to be satisfied with the job of deputy.
I don't know, but according to you, somebody tried to kill him, and you never can tell if they might come back and try to finish the job.
So you don't think Maynard hit him or murdered the girl?
I slipped the truck into reverse and waited a full 5 seconds for it to engage.
At this point in the investigation, I'm not ruling out anyone.
Chapter 15. Daddy.
It was possible that Tuyen had been attacked, but had he been hit twice, or was it a setup?
Daddy?
I had pushed him, but had I pushed him enough? Was I pushing the wrong guy?
Daddy?
I focused on my daughter, who was giving me hard looks as Henry chuckled and the collective Moretti's smiled and continued eating the hors d'oeuvres. Sorry. I picked up a stuffed mushroom from the appetizer tray and glanced at Michael for a little backup as he helped himself to another Rocky Mountain oyster. The Philadelphia beat cop came in like a champ with a little mind reading.
So you don't think this Tuyen is on the level?
I chewed the mushroom, not tasting much of anything, and looked around at the interior of the Winchester restaurant and the replica antique firearms over the fireplace. I'm not sure how or how deep he's involved, but something just doesn't ring true with the guy. I looked at Henry, who I'm sure was reading my mind. For him it had been a lifetime of vacation.
What do you think?
The Cheyenne Nation sighed.
He is spooky. Once a spook, always a spook.
I thought about the old term for spies, nodded, and looked at Vic. I was still trying to get used to her in a white-ribbed tank top and a tight, short skirt.
What do you think?
She munched on a fried cheese stick and extended a hand, holding the palm down flat, shaking the turquoise bracelets at her wrist as her manicured hand wavered. Then I watched as she took another breaded steer testicle from the center platter and placed it onto Michael's plate. I still wasn't sure if he knew what he was eating.
One of the things that keeps snagging me is the preciseness of the hanging.
I caught the eye of an elderly woman at the next table, and Katie glared at me, causing me to lower my voice and lean in.
The hanging was textbook, the drop according to height and weight, and there's only a limited number of people in the common populace who would know.